Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Dr. Arik Kirschenbaum, zoologist, college lecturer, and fellow at Girton College, University of Cambridge. And we're talking about his book, The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, What Animals on Earth Reveal About Aliens and Ourselves. Dr. Kirschenbaum, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book. This is a wild book, and it's a well-written book, but it's got some interesting premises. First of all, you feel that we're increasingly confident that there is life elsewhere in the universe, and that we might possibly find it. Now, you're talking about any kind of life or intelligent life?
I think we're talking about simple life first. You know, we're gonna discover bit by bit what's going on in the universe. We're gonna discover the commonest things first, and from what we see now, from what we see looking into space with the new instruments that we've got, new instruments that are coming online, there are a lot of planets out there that can support at least simple life. So it seems likely we're going to find something fairly simple fairly soon.
I think even within our own solar system, we could find some at least simple life.
And you know, we've had some interesting discoveries on Venus of strange chemical reactions that we don't really know how to explain them. And certainly there are targets for investigations on the moons of Jupiter and Saturn as well. So, yeah, it's quite possible.
Now, this book takes a scientific approach to draw conclusions about alien life. And mostly you're talking about, in this case, complex life and even intelligent life, but just complex life in particular. How can we possibly make assumptions about what they're like? That sort of seems like a huge leap.
Well, it depends what your assumptions are based on. If your assumptions are based on premises which are really likely to hold and under all these conditions and on these strange planets and possibly very different environments, then those are good assumptions to make. We make assumptions about the laws of physics. We don't have any problems with that. We believe that the laws of physics apply on other worlds just like they apply here. And it turns out there are laws of biology as well, and they will also apply even if the outcome, the result, the creatures, the organisms that are the result of that may not look anything like what we know, but there are still rules that they have to follow, and these are rules of the evolutionary processes.
And this is what surprises me about your book, because I always just assumed, until I read your book, that when we're talking about biology and zoology of planet Earth, it's so particular to our planet that alien life, I always expect, is going to be so dramatically different that we may not even recognize it as life.
I think that there are going to be a lot of surprises. I'm sure that's true. But the key point, I mean, the real cornerstone of what I'm saying is that complex life, complexity, any kind of complexity, it can't just arise by itself, right? So if there is complex life on another planet, it can only have got there through this very well understood process that we know of evolution by natural selection. That's the only way that complexity can accumulate. That's nothing special about Earth. That's not a particular property to Earth. That's a universal process.
Now talk to me, define natural selection, because that's one of the keystone principles of your book. What does natural selection mean?
So the simplest way to put it is that its favorable traits accumulate. So if you have some kind of organism, or even not even an organism, some prebiotic system, and for whatever reason it accumulates some improvement, something that helps it to survive and to reproduce better and more effectively and to survive more, then that improvement is going to persist. It's going to spread throughout the population, and you'll see that more. And then more other improvements come on top of that. And on top of that, it's this accumulation of favorable traits of whatever they may be that is what causes life to become more and more complex. And that's essentially what evolution is.
But isn't this process dependent upon DNA?
Not at all. And in fact, we observe evolution by natural selection, or very similar processes conforming to the same sorts of mathematical rules in non-living things. We see it in software, You can see it in cultural ideas as well. Cultural ideas often also spread in a very similar way. You know, they're either successful, so you get people following a particular ideology, or you don't. If it's successful, it converts new converts and so on. So it's actually a process that can apply not just to biology and certainly not just on Earth.
Now, this just summing up, what you're saying is that beneficial traits accumulate, and that equals evolutionary fitness?
That's essentially what's driving the very existence of complex life, yes. Yeah, there's a lot more to it. Now, there's a lot more details, of course.
And the details are in the book. I want to mention, for the benefit of the audience, we're talking very generally, but trust me, the book brings you along with all the details that you'd want to know. Now, you also have a concept of convergence. Now, why is that important when we're trying to figure out alien life?
It's often thought that alien life, as you said, is going to be so alien, so different, that we can't possibly imagine what it could be like. But there are a couple of reasons why that can't be the case. One is that the different ways of solving the kinds of problems that life faces are really limited, right? They're really constrained. There aren't an infinite number of ways of, for instance, getting energy. So the commonest form of energy for most life would be energy from a star, from the sun, essentially. How do you convert that into usable energy? Well, the laws of physics constrain that. There aren't an infinite number of different ways that you can do that. And so whereas plants on Earth capture sunlight and turn it into chemical energy, that's something that organisms on other planets are going to have to do as well, because life has to have energy. So convergence is really reflecting the fact that there aren't an infinite number of ways to solve problems, that the similar sorts of solutions will keep cropping up because they're the only ones that are available.
One of the great examples you give in the book is flight, which evolved four different times, well, in four different groups of creatures.
That's right. Flight is a perfect example of something that's constrained by physics. You know, there's actually not that many ways that you can stay up without falling down. There are really only two useful ways to do it. You can either float, or you can have wings. You can have an aerodynamic or a hydrodynamic effect that counteracts the effect of gravity. So it's not surprising that the same solutions have occurred over and over again, that birds fly and bats fly, and for that matter, that fish float. This is also a kind of flight.
Yep, right.
But we see these same solutions coming back over and over again, simply because that's what physics dictates.
Well, flight evolved also once for pterosaurs, which are not around anymore, and also insects fly. So those were four different solutions, and they're completely different solutions to the same problem.
They are different in their detail, but they're
But they accomplish
similar.
The same thing.
They accomplish the same thing, and they accomplish the same thing using very, very similar concepts. So although it's true that insect flight is very, very different from bird or bat or pterosaur flight, and that's largely because of their size, that's dictated by their size, which is, again, a physical constraint. But you can see the same principles working, and this wing, this business of having wings, that's not something special about Earth. That's something special about how to counteract gravity.
But you can have more than a pair. You could have two wings, two sets of wings, like dragonflies do.
You certainly can, and of course, I'm not saying that an alien planet will have creatures with wings that look just like wings on our planet, but they will almost certainly be using the same aerodynamic principles as are used on Earth.
Well, you can also invent flight, like we did.
Yes, but we use wings. I mean,
yeah, but
that principle of so we don't flap the wings, of course, but then pterosaurs probably didn't flap very much either. It's the principle of using the flow of air over a wing surface to generate lift that is used repeatedly over and over again.
Now, this is one of the things that I was sort of blown away that you considered. And the question is, will aliens have sex? And why? Couldn't they just sort of butt off, you know, like a polyp?
And of course, most organisms on Earth do that. So it was the first way of reproducing.
But then we're talking about complex life, and that's sort of changes everything.
That does. change everything because, firstly, I think we can expect that, that when we finally do get to investigate life on other planets, when we have the instruments that will be able to see what's going on other planets, the atmospheres and so on, the vast majority of these planets will probably be restricted to very simple life. Very simple life is probably very common. But for complex life to evolve, for those planets where complex life has evolved, that's a different story. Something is probably making evolution go that much faster, that exploiting that many more different niches. And sex has a very important role to play in the speed of evolution. Because if you're just budding off offspring one after the other and they're all clones, they're all identical to you,
right,
there's very little scope for new variety, for new traits, for new characteristics to come into being. If you're taking your characteristics and mixing them with someone else's characteristics, then your offspring are going to be very different. And so it's generally thought that sex has sped up the pace of evolution.
Huh.
Not necessarily why it arose, so it's not necessarily why it evolved, but that does seem to be an effect of sex, that it makes evolution happen a lot quicker.
It's interesting, though, there's a few, maybe only one case of vertebrae giving birth to clones. I think it's a race runner lizard in the southwest of the United States where they're all females and they all give birth to genetically identical individuals. And so when I look at that, is that that's obviously just a dead end. They're not going to go anywhere. They're not going to evolve into anything else. That's it.
Well, of course, evolution doesn't have any foresight. There's no plan. There's no grand plan. You know, these organisms are not thinking, well, this is an evolutionary dead end. I better not go down that way. No, organisms develop particular traits if it helps them at that point in time. And you quite often see evolutionary innovations, which you might think would be disadvantageous in the long term. But of course, the long term doesn't matter. The only thing that's important is the short term. If it helps them in the short term, if it helps them to have more offspring and to be more successful, then that's a property that will spread.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Dr. Eric Kirschenbaum, zoologist, college lecturer, and fellow at Girton College, University of Cambridge. And we're talking about his book. It's a book that'll start 1,000 discussions. The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, What Animals on Earth Reveal About Aliens and Ourselves. And there was an interesting section in the middle of the book where you start even, can we even define what an animal is, what complex life is? It's not that simple. We can't even define human life necessarily clearly. And you bring up the interesting example of prehistorically, there were several human species that were alive at the same time. And do those all, if they were alive today, would those all rate the rights that we have?
Yeah, definitions are difficult. Definitions are difficult, and you always have to question just how useful they really are. And people worry a lot about things like definition of life, definition of intelligence, and things like that. But definitions are useful when they make useful distinctions. So, for instance, the definition of animal, which I talk about quite a lot, is a useful distinction because there are fundamentally different strategies to getting your energy if you're alive. One is you stay where you are and you just gather energy passively from whatever's around you, which is usually sunlight, is where most of the energy is. And then another strategy is to go out and take your energy from someone else. That could be eating plants, it could be eating other animals, but you're getting your energy from someone else who's already gathered it from the surroundings. And that's essentially what animals are. Animals are organisms that go out and get their food from someone else. That's a useful distinction. It defines two very different types of strategies, two very different types of ways of approaching life. There are definitions that are less helpful. Definition of human, if it doesn't make that much difference whether you're a Neanderthal or a Homo sapiens, then that may or may not be a useful definition. But I think with animals, it's fairly clear cut. We've got something that's very, very different from plants going on here.
But in the case of some simple animals, like say polyps, where they anchor in place and just get stuff that comes by, particles of food, Does that make them not an animal?
Well, the definition of animal that we use on Earth is one based on evolutionary heritage, on family tree. So anything that's descended from the original animal, the very first animal, we don't really know what that was, got some ideas, not quite sure, but anything that's descended from that original animal is an animal. That's the way we define things with life on Earth. So, of course, there are plenty of animals that have evolved to be less animal-like, to be more like plants, to sit still and to gather food as it comes by. That doesn't alter their evolutionary heritage.
Got it.
But it does mean that the niche that they occupy, their strategy for living in the world, it doesn't fit what's typical of animals. But again, that's because evolution has no goal. They'll do what's best for them at any particular point in time.
So bringing this around back to the discussion of extraterrestrials, does that mean if the creatures that we meet on some exoplanet, as long as they exhibit certain basic characteristics, they would be considered animals? And how would we ever consider them on par with a human? What is it that makes us human? And that brings back that discussion about Australopithecines, Neanderthals, Denisovians. I mean, the whole hominid group. Is there a thing where we go, yeah, this is where humans started, and then it's the rest? And does that mean great apes are also can be considered any kind of human?
Well, I would say that again, the definition is useful if it really distinguishes two functionally different groups. So to come back to your example of animals first, before we talk about humans, I could certainly imagine an organism on another planet that is an animal and photosynthesizes.
Right.
Sort of Groot
right.
character.
Right.
So it may gather energy from the environment and go out and eat.
That's like the movie The Thing, in the original film of The Thing, where it was a plant that moved around and also got food.
Absolutely. And the Day of the Triffids as well.
That's right. And I want to mention, by the way, for the benefit of the audience, you make numerous science fiction references, which are great.
Well, I think science fiction is very helpful. Very often it raises some really interesting questions. But so in this case, when you're asking, is it a plant, is it an animal, then the question is that a useful term? For me, it's useful. When I talk about animals in my book, it's useful because if you go out and search for your food, there are a lot of consequences. There are a lot of consequences for how you evolve, for what kind of interactions you have with other individuals. Eventually, will you become social? Will you start to live in groups? We start to have families and so on. So there are a lot of down the line implications of it. Does it matter if you photosynthesize? No, you can have photosynthetic animals that still will be constrained by the kind of laws of society and sociality, just like non-photosynthetic animals on Earth are.
So most likely complex life on another planet will move. They may do it in a number of different ways, but they will move.
I think it's very likely that there will be movement, and that's because if everyone is just sitting still, if only plants are around and they're just gathering sunlight and sitting still, there's a huge advantage to being an organism that exploits these passive static animals. So that huge advantage means that there's a strong selective pressure for that movement to evolve.
Does that mean that alien life would most likely have some kind of analog to legs?
It's an interesting observation. Think about it, that there's no animal on Earth, I say that someone will probably think of one, that moves by dragging itself along the ground. It's so inefficient to drag yourself along the ground. Even snails don't really drag themselves along the ground because they secrete a fluid that will reduce the friction between them and the floor. So dragging yourself along the ground is just a terrible, terrible, terrible idea. And the easiest way to deal with that is to be in contact with the ground just enough so that you can push, just enough so that you can get yourself moving. And that's what a leg is. Legs have nothing to do with life on Earth, nothing special about Earth. It's all about the mechanics of moving along a solid surface.
And there's right here on this planet, there's a tremendous variety of things that serve the function as legs. I think you gave out the example of the peripatus, the weird invertebrate that has these sort of bulb-like things on the bottom. There are, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different analogs to legs, but most life has it.
That's right, and my favorite is the tube feet of echinoderms, of sea urchins and
yeah,
starfish and
yeah.
stuff. And they just sort of like squeeze part of their body out through a little hole in their shell, and it becomes a leg-like appendage, and they can move like that. But the point is, what they're all doing, is reducing the contact of the body with the ground, so you reduce friction, but you can still get enough grip to move yourself along.
How likely would it be that extraterrestrials would be bilaterally symmetrical?
We see this as a hugely dominant feature of animals on Earth. So almost all, 95% of the species, or 99% of the species on Earth are bilaterally symmetrical. That means they've got a left side and a right side. And because movement is such a crucial part of being an animal, because you're going out and looking for food, these symmetrical animals have just taken over. It's just so much more efficient to move when you have a left side and a right side. One reason is, of course, if you have a left side and a right side, you can have a front and a back. So, you know, if you're going somewhere and you've got a front and a back, then you automatically get a left and a right. But it's also a lot of the movement strategies, a lot of the ways that animals move involve alternating limbs or fins or even just like the undulation of a manta ray. Still, it's that left-right divide that makes movement very, very efficient.
But we have some good examples of radially symmetrical animals, like we mentioned starfish, octopus, and those aren't really bilaterally symmetrical. They're really radially symmetrical. So you could imagine extraterrestrial life that adopted radial symmetry and still be quite advanced.
Well, interestingly, both those examples that you gave are actually bilaterally symmetrical, but they've just chosen, again, to change their shape and to change the way that they move, because it suits their environment more to be, in the case of starfish, radially symmetrical, but they're actually bilaterally symmetrical in origin. There are animals that are not bilaterally symmetrical, jellyfish,
yep.
Corals, and there are some that are quite good at moving. So there's a kind of animal called a ctenophore, which moves really quite quickly through the sea using undulating body parts, but it's radially symmetrical. So it's not impossible, but the interesting thing is that the incredible dominance of the bilaterally symmetric species on Earth implies there's a really big advantage there. And it's hard to imagine an ecosystem on an alien planet covered in non-symmetrical animals where a bilaterally symmetric animal wouldn't have a huge advantage. So it's quite likely they would sweep the board there as well.
We're going to run out of time before I've asked you most of the questions, but one of the crucial things that you talk about in the book, and you mentioned it as one of the most important questions, is would aliens be social? And you talk about what are the advantages to living in groups, and you talk about cooperation and the significance of altruistic behavior. So your belief is they're most likely, especially if it's an intelligent life form, they're going to be social.
Yeah, sociality is another one of those things that is very widespread on Earth, and it's not anything to do with Earth. It's to do with these fundamental laws of evolution, and there are a few things that come into play here. One, of course, is there are some very sort of physical reasons it's advantageous to be social. You know, you've got more protection, and you can build things and so on. But there's another reason why sociality evolves, and that's coming back to sex. If you reproduce and you have offspring, and your offspring are related to you, then evolution is going to make you want to look after your offspring. It's an advantage for you to ensure your offspring's survival. And so at the very least, family groups are really an inevitable part of the evolutionary process. Of course, there are plenty of animals that don't care for their offspring. They adopt a different strategy of just having as many as possible and hoping that some will survive. But there's always a niche. There's always an opportunity for some animals that are going to look after their young and to make sure that they're better off at surviving. And that's really the kernel of sociality on Earth. And it's not specific to Earth.
And language is another thing you talk about a lot in the book. And you feel that's what separates humans from animals. Aren't there some animals that have like the rudiments, like corvids, the rudiments of a language?
This is a difficult question. This is a question that, again, comes back to definitions. Are we happy to divide the world into animals with language and animals without language? Is language something with such a important definition that we can make that distinction? Probably not. Probably, as you say, there's a gradation of how complex the communication of animals can be, and for sure ours is much, much, much more complex. It may even be qualitatively different from everyone else's. Does that justify this hard division? I'm not sure. It's certainly true that everything we see around us that humans do is the result of us having language, the reason
right.
that we
right.
have radio programs, you know, the reason that we write books, the reason that we explore space. This could not be done without language. This could not be done without the ability to cooperate in great, great detail as we do. So it's certainly important, but then defining it is another story. We could have a whole radio show on that.
And we're completely out of time. My guest tonight is Dr. Eric Kirschenbaum, zoologist, college lecturer, and fellow at Girton College, University of Cambridge. When we've been talking about his book, like I mentioned before, we've just been talking about general issues. This book really goes into things in depth and will cause 1,000 discussions. The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy: What Animals on Earth Reveal About Aliens and Ourselves. Dr. Kirschenbaum, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. It's been great fun.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.